Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Leute, es wird unangenehm, denn ich muss euch einfach fragen, habt ihr euch eigentlich schon mal um eure Versicherung gekümmert? Hier ist übrigens Tara vom Podcast Tara sagt was und ich sage euch, es wird allerhöchste Zeit, Ordnung in euer Versicherungschaos zu bringen und dabei kann euch die App Clark helfen. Da arbeiten ganz viele Expertinnen, die das hauptberuflich machen, man glaubt es kaum. Und mit meinem Code TARA60, alles groß und zusammengeschrieben, könnt ihr euch sogar einen Shopping-Gutschein sichern, 60 Euro, bei zum Beispiel Amazon oder Douglas einlösbar, mit dem Code TARA60.
The world is facing a shortage of tradespeople. The metaverse can help solve that problem. With a virtual reality training platform developed by ForgeFX, aspiring welders can practice over and over. As a result, students learn the specialized skills they need to begin and advance welding careers. Meta and the metaverse are having impact today.
Hello, I'm James Reynolds. Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service. In BBC OS Conversations, we bring people together to share their experiences. This week, we return to the war in Israel and Gaza and catch up with people living in Israel. Iran's drone and missile attack on Israel last week heightened tensions in the Middle East. Days of international diplomacy followed amid fears that the conflict could spiral out of control. In today's edition, three Israelis describe what it was like during the attack on their country. They also share how they feel they're perceived and, because of their Jewish faith, persecuted.
I now know what every generation of Jews has been through. All the libels that the world has put out about us now are the same libels that we've had for generations, and they live through it. So all we live through it or we don't, and that's the reality for Jews.
The war between Israel and Hamas is now in its seventh month. Seemingly, there is no immediate prospect of an end. As we record this on Friday morning, it is unclear how the situation will develop. After Iran's unprecedented attack on Israel, we're currently watching updates from Iran of what appears to be a retaliatory strike by Israel. The backdrop to all of this is the war in Gaza, where Israel is attacking Hamas, and Hamas is backed by Iran. Previously on this program, we shared with you voice notes from young women in Gaza. And on our weekday program, we've heard the voices of protesters in Israel, including those of families of hostages held in Gaza. And today, we bring together three residents of Israel. Such was the depth of the discussion that we wanted to share as much as we could. So we have just this one conversation to bring you this week. A quick reminder before we get into it. The current conflict began when Hamas-led gunmen carried out an attack on southern Israel on the 7th of October. The gunmen killed around 1,200 people and took around 250 hostages into Gaza. Around 100 are still being held. Since then, according to the Hamas-run health ministry, more than 33,800 people have been killed in Gaza after Israeli attacks. The majority of those are women and children. So let me introduce you to our three guests in Israel. Leah is a farmer and a mother of four. Leah's not her real name. She wanted to protect her identity. She lives just a few kilometers from the border with Gaza. Avi's a father and lives just outside the coastal city of Tel Aviv. He works in property development. And our third guest is Leanne, also from Tel Aviv. She is a strategic security advisor and a mother of three young kids. When I spoke to them earlier this week, we began by talking about last weekend. I should add that our guests do give details that you might find upsetting.
Saturday night was one of the scariest nights of my life, but on the other hand, also a night where I felt very proud to be Israeli. Scary because it was the first time since the Gulf War in 1991 that Israel was attacked by a sovereign state. And although we very much trust our defense system and the Air Force, no defense system is 100% accurate. And it was such a massive attack and so unprecedented. We equipped the safe room with everything that you can imagine, from food supplies to nappies to water to battery chargers, whatever is needed for a few days to stay there because we really did not know what to expect. You really felt the tension in the air. we did not sleep one wink that night. On the other hand, there was a lot of sense of patriotism and being proud of being Israeli because of the cutting edge and innovative systems that we put in place over 35 years ago, and you saw them in action, as well as an understanding that we're not alone. So, because I think on October 7th and the months following that, a lot of times I think the average Israeli felt like they weren't understood and they were alone in the world. And that night was really like a preview to what the new world could look like, because that coalition, the free world, UK obviously included, as well as the moderate Arab world, working together to defend humanity from extremism, I felt very proud that night to be part of that free world.
It was very scary, the same as Liam, very scary. We heard the action. We were watching the television all the time. Any station, they all, you know, were blowing. It's happening, it's happening, it's happening. And it was scary. But we didn't have one siren, nothing. So eventually, I said to my wife, you know what, forget about it. Let's just try and go to sleep and hope for the best. And let's see what's in the morning. It was one of the scariest nights because we didn't know what to expect. But we have the confidence in the system. And the Army or the Air Force had to rebuild the confidence that they lost to a lot of people in Israel following what's happened in October 7th.
I've had 28 years of missiles over me. It really wasn't any different. Like, missiles kill, whether they're from Iran or proxies of Iran. For me, it was a normal experience. I did not intend to come and live in an area that would be under missile fire so constantly, and that my children would go to schools where, over the years, we have done so much campaigning to get bomb shelters. I mean, in the early days, they'd come home from school after hiding under tables from missile attacks. I mean, like farming, I'm a farmer. So, you know, you don't expect to go to your field with your workers and just luckily you see that there's a bomb on the netting that goes over your clementine trees and you have to call in the bomb squad. We have very quickly learned that we have 30 seconds and we have to run. And we have a safe place to go because Israel cares about human lives, whereas it seems Hamas doesn't. Otherwise, they might have put some of their money that was found in their houses, all those millions of shekels and millions of dollars that they had in their houses, could have gone to some nice bomb shelters. So not so many Palestinians would have died and they wouldn't have to be scared. Like, I wasn't that scared.
Looking back at life since October the 7th in Israel, Leanne, you're a mum of three young kids. How has life changed for you and your family?
I guess it's life before the 7th and life after the 7th. That's kind of two chapters. October 7th hit us close to home without it being directly affecting my immediate family, and I'll explain. We had a family of survivors, our friends, who came to our place on October 7th. Two adults, four kids, and a dog, completely barefoot. They had a kitchen knife with them. They had a gun with them with no ammunition anymore because they obviously faced various terrorists that tried to murder them on the way. And basically that's how October 7th started with us. From that day on, everything that we're doing is taking care of those families, taking care of the orphans. We opened an organization. We launched an organization taking care of the orphans of this war, and there are many. And sleepless nights thinking about the hostages there, because I have two boys, for example, that are the same age as the two boys that are still there, Ariel and Kfir Bibas. And whenever I go to sleep at night, if I get some sleep, and whenever I wake up, all I think about is those two boys that are held by Hamas. What's going on with them? Are they still alive? Are they able to get some food? You know, everything has changed. Everything has changed. That's all we think about. We're a traumatized nation. And we understand also not only that things will never be the same, but also we understand that what we're facing with is really the most brutal kind of terrorism. What Hamas did to us to our sisters, to our children, to our grandmothers, to our grandfathers, to our girls, and is still doing today, is the most brutal kind of terrorism, using rape as an act of war, slaughtering our families, burning people alive, killing babies in front of their mothers. It's the really the worst kind of extremism and terrorism one can face. And that's what we're carrying with us since October 7th. And obviously with the hostages still there, we are very far from being able to recuperate ever since.
And Avi, can I add something?
Avi, go ahead.
Yeah, can I add something? I want to take it to a different angle. I accept 100% what the two ladies said, but I'm bringing out another thing, is how did the world react to what happened, okay? First of all, how bad was the Israeli PR coming out of Israel? Bad, 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 okay? And I'm a television freak. So since then, I've been going, moving from television to television to international. And I could see the change, okay, from being supportive on Israel. But, you know, within very short period of time, all of a sudden, they forgot about it, okay? Now it's the terrible Israelis slaughtering Arabs, slaughtering kids in Gaza.
But wasn't that obvious, Avi? Because when I've been through 28 years of missile fire here, what happens is we get months of attacks on us, trickling attacks, 2 or 3 missiles a day, and then eventually they hit somebody or something. And then the news suddenly doesn't report on all of the attacks we've been under, that we've run from, and that our kids have come home from school, that they've been under tables again. And all they show is that we attacked Gaza.
To listen to the BBC, I'm talking about British broadcasting, and avoiding or refusing to use the word terrorist, what are they? The freedom fighters, are they? This, and I lived in England for 5 years, okay, in the 70s. Since then, I've been a few times, and now I refuse to come back into England. I refuse. It's like, what happened to you guys? What are you waiting for? It's like, I don't trust the world anymore.
I've heard what you said about international coverage, and in no way could I, sitting here, talk about other organizations, but I would simply say that on the program we do, and here at the BBC, we spent many, many hours speaking to bereaved Israelis in the hours, weeks, the days after the 7th of October, speaking to people evacuated from Kfar Aza, from Kibbutz Be'eri, hearing their stories, hearing them cry, and sending teams across Israel.
I think the general sense of the average Israeli is simply the fact that after October 7th, yes, there was a lot of coverage of what's going on the Israeli side. But as the war progressed, we started feeling more and more misunderstood and more alone. And maybe perhaps what has changed in the last few days since the Iranian attack is really that feeling that maybe the world is starting to get it.
Leanne, Avi and Leah, and we'll return to that conversation in just a moment. Picking up on what Avi and Leanne said about the coverage of the war and the use of the word terrorist in reports, it is the BBC's long-standing position for its presenters and reporters not to use the word terrorist unless attributing it to someone else. Across our reporting, we've explained that Hamas is prescribed as a terrorist organisation by many Western governments. We've reflected the response from the international community to Hamas's actions, and as in today's edition, we feature contributors who describe Hamas as terrorists. This is BBC OS Conversations with Israeli families from the BBC World Service. I'm James Reynolds.
Hallo, hier sind Julia und Chris vom Podcast Drinis. Wir machen nicht nur einen Comedy-Podcast, sondern gehen auch leidenschaftlich gerne nicht zu Stoßzeiten in den Supermarkt. Ehrlich gesagt bleibe ich am liebsten ganz zu Hause und ziehe nur eine Hose an, wenn es klingelt. Wenn es euch auch so geht, dann ist HelloFresh genau das Richtige für euch. Der Kochbox-Lieferservice bringt euch frische, abwechslungsreiche Gerichte direkt vor die Haustür, die ihr im Handumdrehen selbst zubereiten könnt.
Und mit dem Code LECKER24 könnt ihr jetzt richtig sparen. In Deutschland bis zu 120 Euro, in Österreich bis zu 130 Euro und in der Schweiz bis zu 140 Franken. Also Code LECKER24 eingeben und sparen.
PS, der panierte Portobello-Pilz mit Sweet Chili Ketchup ist sehr gut.
Leute, es wird unangenehm, denn ich muss euch einfach fragen, habt ihr euch eigentlich schon mal um eure Versicherung gekümmert? Hier ist übrigens Tara vom Podcast Tara sagt was und ich sage euch, es wird allerhöchste Zeit, Ordnung in euer Versicherungschaos zu bringen und dabei kann euch die App Clark helfen. Da arbeiten ganz viele Expertinnen, die das hauptberuflich machen, man glaubt es kaum. Und mit meinem Code TARA60, alles groß und zusammengeschrieben, könnt ihr euch sogar einen Shopping-Gutschein sichern. 60 Euro bei zum Beispiel Amazon oder Douglas einlösbar mit dem Code TARA60.
Let's return now to our three guests in Israel. And when we spoke, understandably, the conversation was still shaped by the attack and the continuing aftermath of the 7th of October attacks.
At 6:30 in the morning, I heard missile fire, but I really understood very quickly after 28 years of it that this was different, because even though we've had hundreds of missiles before, the pace of them was beyond anything we've ever seen. It was red alert, red alert, red alert, red alert, red alert, red alert, nonstop, nonstop, nonstop. The next thing I know, my friend is ringing me, telling me that her whole family are burning in a bomb shelter in Be'eri, and they don't think they're going to live. And they only know that if they can get out the burning bomb shelter, there are terrorists with guns that are going to kill them. And they died. And if you want to know what was the scariest day of my life, that was the scariest day of my life. I thought to myself, how did they survive in the Shoah, in the Holocaust, for months and years living like that? One day is enough to do your head in completely. How did they survive knowing people wanted to kill them every second? My daughter's got a friend here now, so I asked her some questions, like for the show, and I said, you know, what's your life like after October the 7th? And she goes, destroyed. My life is destroyed. They killed half her friends. She's got four friends kidnapped in Gaza. The intent of Hamas, the charter of Hamas, is to destroy Israel. Israel doesn't want to kill anyone at all. No one. The last thing they want to do is kill someone, because for us, a person is a world. I now know what every generation of Jews has been through. My grandparents, my great-grandparents, and I don't know beyond that, because obviously we've moved so many times from persecution that we can't really go too much further than that. But they went through it. We went through it. They've been called the names, and all the libels that the world has put out about us now are the same libels that we've had for generations, and they lived through it. So all we live through it or we don't. And that's the reality for Jews.
I also went through this. Some of my relatives were fighting in Be'eri. They were from one of the commando units. They were one of the first group who came in. They had a lot of friends killed in Be'eri and all this. I'm talking about a week later, when we wake up, if we wake up, and we ask the question, the Israeli question, where the hell was the army? We always trusted. I was in the army for 3 years and blah, blah, blah. But what happened there? I mean, all the promises about this fantastic Israeli intelligent and we are secure and whatever, yeah, and nothing happened.
Leanne, I do want to ask you a question.
Sure.
In the days after the 7th of October attacks, we, of course, spoke to so many Israelis. And also when phone lines were working, we spoke to Palestinians in Gaza. And I remember asking those we could get through to, what did they make of the fact that so many Israeli civilians, parents, kids, children were killed on the 7th of October? And I wanted to get some of those answers. And I wonder now, months later, asking that question in return, of people in Israel, what do you make of the scale of Palestinian deaths in Gaza?
First of all, it's really important to say this war has been the most just war in the history of Israel. I mean, there's absolutely no question about it. As Leah mentioned earlier, the last thing that Israel wants to see is civilians being killed. And the IDF is doing tremendous efforts to avoid such killing.
And does that stack up with what we see?
It does, and I'll explain. First of all, what you're seeing is tremendous efforts to evacuate the civic population as much as possible. And the problem is that Hamas does not allow them to evacuate because it is in Hamas's interest to see as many Palestinians being killed as possible. And I know it's crazy to believe, because we all want to believe that leaders want to protect their population, but that's not true in that specific case.
And Leanne, I wonder if I could just put another point. Sure. You've worked with international organizations, you've worked with Israeli allies, and you'll know that those allies led by President Biden are saying that Israel is not doing enough to protect Palestinian civilians in Gaza. That this is not just criticism coming from activists. This is criticism with evidence coming from Israel's allies, that Israel is not doing enough.
What kind of evidence?
I was putting that question to Leanne, and I hope Leanne can have a chance to respond.
Look, I think that criticism to some extent is expected because, you know, we are the responsible westernized country, and we are expected to act to certain standards. I don't accept the criticism about the efforts.
From Israel's main ally.
We completely respect our allies. I personally want to thank President Biden for everything that he's doing for Israel, really. And what you're seeing that across the board, including that night that we spoke about with the Iranian attack. But I know from firsthand about the efforts that are being done within the IDF to protect civilian lives, and both in terms of the intention as well as in terms of the facts. When you look at the proportions of how many civilians were killed comparing to terrorists, they are incredibly low if you compare to any war that you compare to, driven by the UK and the US involved. The numbers are extremely low. And not only that, what happens is that Israel, the IDF, puts our own soldiers in danger. A lot of soldiers are being injured and killed in order to protect civilian lives.
But I think, again, you'll know as well as I do, looking at the numbers, that there is still investigations going on as to how many civilians were killed and how many armed men were killed. But there is no dispute whatsoever that among the dead, named dead, are many, many, many civilians.
I understand. I agree. And to me, it is terrible. It is terrible. I don't want to see, and all any Israeli that you ask, any normal Israeli, will tell you the same. We do not want to see civilians being killed. But we have to realize we are at war against the most radical, extreme terrorist organization that protects itself by using its own population as human shields. And that's the reality of war. Look at Shifa Hospital. They took a place that is supposed to provide remedy, a place where mothers go and give birth, a place where people should get medication for cancer. And what did they do with it? They converted it into a terrorist infrastructure center. And what Israel now had to do, and did it remarkably well, is to dismantle this terrorist infrastructure whilst trying to protect the civilian population there. It is an impossible situation that they put the civilian society in. And that's what we have to deal with. And Israel does tremendous efforts. And you know what? Sometimes even mistakes happen. Look at what happened with the World Central Kitchen. It is a terrible, terrible tragedy. And Israel took full responsibility, and it's the kind of terrible things that happen when you are at war.
It's a television war. Think about during the World War II. That's the best thing for the British. When they started to attack Dresden, did anybody, you know, said anything? How many thousands and thousands of Germans, civilians, were killed in this bombing? No. It's a war, and they had to stop it. I said the same thing about we shouldn't kill anyone. But what are we facing here?
I mean, it has to stop, and I know it's never going to stop. Okay, even if we're not going to kill all of them. Okay, they're going to surrender, whatever. But give them a few more years, them or another group like this will try again.
Israelis Avi, Lian, and Leah. The IDF is the Israel Defense Forces. Lian spoke about its raids on Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City that Israel described as a key command and control center for Hamas. Hospitals have protected status during times of war under international humanitarian law, but they can lose that protection in limited circumstances if they're being used to commit what's described as an act harmful to the enemy. Israel has been criticized for targeting Gaza's health facilities during the war, and in a recent statement, the Hamas-run health ministry said that Israeli forces were using fabricated narratives to justify its actions. Thanks to our guests this week for sharing their experiences. I'm James Reynolds. You've been listening to The Documentary from the BBC World Service.
Cataracts are the world's leading cause of avoidable blindness. The metaverse can help address that problem. A virtual reality platform created by Fundamental VR and Orbis International helps train doctors to treat cataracts, resulting in more confident surgeons operating all over the world. With virtual reality training, surgeons can practice over and over to gain skills. Meta and the metaverse are having impact today.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We meet people with smart ideas to discover how they might change the world for the better.
And this is a fairly cheap and easy way to get lots more solar capacity into the middle of cities.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
Listen now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.